Very welcome to this seminar. This is the second event in the Rethinking the Cold War lecture series, and that is a collaboration between the Cold War Studies project here at LSE Ideas and the Cultures of the Cold War network at the University of Sheffield. Now there's a whole series of exciting things coming up in that. We're going to have Mark Bradley coming to speak in February. And then Arne Westad, once, of course, of the LSE, but nowadays of Harvard, coming to talk about his new magnum opus in April. So there's a lot to look forward to, but there's also a lot to look forward to this evening, as we're going to be talking about nuclear war, or perhaps an imagined nuclear war, and we have no fewer than three speakers. So I'm going to briefly introduce all of them. I also have to say that the event is being live tweeted, and so if you're here, you don't really need to follow it, but if you're not here, then you can follow it at LSE Ideas. Although if you're not following it already, how do you hear me? I don't know, but that's probably technologically beyond me. And I also have to announce, and again I don't properly understand this, that the Twitter hashtag is hashtag imaginary war. What we're going to be talking about then is imaginary war, and we have three people to introduce this topic. I think in the order that they're going to be speaking, the first is Professor Benjamin Zeman, who's Professor of Modern German History at the University of Sheffield. Then I think we're going to have Dr. Matthew Grant, who is Senior Lecturer in History at the University of Essex. And then finally, we're going to have Professor Anne Sherif, Professor of Japanese, Oberlin College, Oberlin, Ohio. So they're each going to speak for about 15 minutes, and then we're going to move into Q&A. So without further ado, over to you.
Okay, a little bit about the context of this, because this is based on a co-edited collection that Matthew and I have been responsible for, and in which Anne is one of the contributors. And I think before I start off with my specific Germanic segment of this whole enterprise, I should frame a little bit and explain where we are coming from this. I think one of the starting points for our debate and for our enterprise were recent sort of developments in historiography on the Cold War, where over the past two decades or so we have seen a proliferation of this field. So in which basically almost all cultural and social and political phenomena that occurred between 1945 and 1990 were in one way or another contributed to the Cold War. This reminds me of Leopold von Ranke's old dictum, sort of everything is immediate to God. So every television set, every pop song, every political festival, every major political current that happened in the Western world and also in the Soviet Union and potentially globally during these decades was in one way or the other immediate to the Cold War. Now, we have seen for quite a while now kind of a backlash against this development, this expansion and inflation, which it was, in fact, I think, of the concept of the Cold War. And many of the attempts to narrow down and to refocus Cold War studies surely then come back to the nuclear confrontation as one of the key aspects and key specificities of the Cold War, not least because the term Cold War itself was, as we all know, coined by George Orwell in 1945 in direct response to the new situation that had emerged in the wake of the two atomic bombings by the US military in Japan. Now, the specific sort of starting point for our venture then with the imaginary war was precisely the argument that actually in that wider framework of the nuclear confrontation, so with all its strategic, geopolitical, diplomatic, and also technological ramifications, obviously, on which there is, on each of these aspects, there is a broad and increasing literature, that imaginations have a special significance in that context, because that's one of the starting points for our venture, the imaginary, imagining nuclear war and nuclear devastation. That's what we argue was, in fact, one of the main battlegrounds of the Cold War. Sorry, when I say First World War, that's a Freudian slip. I started off with the First World War as a historian. And I want to now, in the following 10 minutes, I want to introduce one intellectual who's hardly known, a German emigre intellectual, who is, in my view, pivotal for our venture. And we have a chapter in this book by Jason Dorsey, an American, young American colleague, who's currently completing or turning into a monograph his work, his PhD dissertation, on Günther Anders, that is that person, is crucial for this venture because he, by sort of conceptual thinking and rethinking, actually pointed out some of the problems that were created by the existence of nuclear weaponry, the atomic bomb, or more precisely actually the hydrogen bomb, because many of the reflections that he offered refer to the situation post the new destructive capacities of the hydrogen bomb. I'm talking about Günther Anders. This is very sort of, basic, but should be enough. born 1902, died in 1992, who fled the Nazis in 1933, going to the United States, but then returned after the Second World War back and lived with his second wife in Vienna. He has a pedigree, was actually born Günther Stern, the son of a famous German psychologist. He adopted Anders as a pseudonym during the emigration in the early 1930s, because Anders means difference in German, and that's precisely what he wanted to hammer down, that sort of difference is a key thing. Was, by the way, Hannah Arendt's first husband, and then also a student of both Edmund Husserl and Martin Heidegger. In 1959, that's my starting point, Anders came to West Berlin, one of the key sort of showcases of Cold War confrontation, and joined students at Free University for a discussion, for a workshop on the moral implications of the bomb. Some of these students edited at that point a journal that was called The Argument, which actually still exists, then sort of a student leaflet more than anything else, now a fairly reputable Marxist political science and sociology journal. Wolfgang Fritz Haug and Frigga Haug, then a couple and still a couple, they have both retired now as professors at Free University Berlin, were part of that circle. And what in sort of following on from that workshop, Anders published in this journal Theses on the Atomic Age. And with Teutonic insistence, I dare say, he tried to hammer out the key characteristics of a new anthropology that was needed after the bomb, quite comparable to the way in which Karl Marx, around about 120 years earlier in 1844, had hammered down his critique of Hegel's and Feuerbach's anthropology in his 11th thesis on Feuerbach, which you all know. The difference between Marx and Anders is that Anders needed 22 theses to come to the point, so he actually doubled the number, basically. What's happening in these theses on the atomic age, which I take to be a very crucial sort of reflection on the Cold War situation, and they have been available for quite a while in an English translation that is coming with its own set of problems, but which is available on JSTOR if you want to check it out. Well, basically, the operation is dialectic inversion. So Anders takes a concept of pre-Hiroshima anthropology and thinking about the human condition and turns it on its head, thereby being very much a disciple of Marx, because that was the very same operation that Marx had, conducted 120 years earlier. And pointing out basically discrepancies between the normal understanding of human agency before the bomb and its erosion in the shadow of the bomb. I give only a few examples here. One of these inversions and problems was the discrepancy between the total power for global self-extinction, quote Anders, and the total powerlessness this caused for mankind. What Anders tried to do here is to intervene and to undermine basically the logic of anti-totalitarianism, Western mainstream liberalism, by stating that to use atomic weapons as a threat was in its very nature totalitarian itself, that's again a quote, since it rested on blackmail and turned the whole earth into an escapeless concentration camp. So to justify the bomb with a totalitarian threat, as it was, mainstream currency obviously at the time, from the East, was thus the climax of hypocrisy. Another target of Anders' intervention was the mendacity, or the contemporary lies that came with discourses to legitimize the Cold War and the use of atomic weapons as a deterrent. So this is pretty much a set of reflections that's also intervening in the whole logic of nuclear deterrence. Already talking about atomic weapons simply as a naked single word, quote Anders, was mendacity because it implied that the bomb was a weapon and thus simply a mere instrument. This is a crucial thing here because Anders implied that due to the, destructive capacity of the bomb, and again, he refers here pretty much to the hydrogen bomb, it could not be used as a means because the use of the bomb as a means would obliterate all future means-ends relations. So the very notion of human agency and instrumental rationality, so human beings using their their inventions and their forecast capacity to forecast and invent and to use instruments would be gone. The ultimate dilemma, though, that's a quote again posed by the bomb for Anders, was something else. It was the discrepancy between the human ability to produce and to imagine. And here we are coming to the core of the Cold War as a bad, or the imaginations of a nuclear destruction as a key battleground of the Cold War. In German, that's rendered even more nicely because to produce, that's herstellen in German, and to imagine is vorstellen. So it's that discrepancy that Anders is interested in. Human beings, in the wake of the bomb, according to Anders, had been turned into inverted utopians, unable to imagine the effects of the very destruction they could produce. His starting point then, obviously we know that this is not true, because there were manifold endeavors, and we will see some of them, and many others are listed sort of and referenced and catalogued and classified and analyzed and historicized in the book. But the point is clear that sort of in the wake of the bomb, there's this gap opening up between the capacity to produce something, but then the problem, at least, if not the inability to imagine what the use of this instrument would actually entail. From this line of thinking, Anders developed his notion of the Promethean slope, or you could also say Promethean gap, referring to the ancient Greek god who, as we all know, had introduced fire to mankind and was subsequently brutally punished by Zeus for doing this. So the issue is that those who trigger the bomb or use the bomb, thereby in fact replacing human agency again, because it's just the triggering, there is not actually human action any longer involved, were morally attached from the effects of their deed. This is the Promethean gap that's opening up, so you cannot any longer actually morally kind of scrutinize and understand and comprehend what the effects of your intervention in atomic war are. For those of you in brackets who have a keen interest in post-structuralist or any other forms of advanced sociological theory, and I would assume there are a few here, in a sense, I think Anders is there one of the precursors of what we nowadays know as actor network theory, where actually technological artifacts are becoming an agency of their own, and the bomb would be a key example for that. This is, in a nutshell, the new anthropology of the post-bomb situation, something that Anders later then developed into his notion of the obsolescence of human beings, the title of his key book that he published in two installments, in the first one in 1956 and then the second one decades later in 1980. There's one more point that I would to add, and that's referring to an awful lot of anti-bomb discourse and also reflection on the consequences of the use of atomic weapons that we find particularly among nuclear pacifists, but not only there, from the 50s basically to the present, and that is the notion of the bomb creating another Auschwitz, or sort of the bomb as a genocidal weapon, which is something that we find very often in this type of anti-nuclear discourse. And here with Anders, Anders begged to differ. He was well aware actually of what was going on. He was from the 50s to the up to his death, I mean, involved and had many contacts in the European movements against atomic weapons, and was, I mean, this venture, this event in 1959, which I started off with, was basically something, a stock-taking after the defeat of the first major anti-nuclear mass movement in Germany, the so-called fight against atomic death movement, of which these students at Free University actually had been a part. But with regard to the notion of a nuclear genocide, Anders differed, because he developed a line of argument where he said that genocide, i.e. the willful destruction of a certain ethnic group or people or ethnic or religious community, is something else than what happens after the deployment of hydrogen bombs, which would potentially be omnicide, i.e. I mean a killing of larger parts of humankind than just a specific ethnic or religious groups. I'm coming to the end of this short interpretation. There would be much more to say about Anders and his thinking. He's, I think, a very, and Jason in his chapter, which is a brilliant chapter, that's simply, I think one should give credit. That's also what I'm doing here, why I'm talking about this and not my contribution to the volume, which is more kind of a survey chapter on developments of thinking, discourse in West Germany from the 50s and 1980s. Anders has been rediscovered for two decades now, and there's a growing interest for his work in German-speaking countries, but still I think English language academia has still to recognize the importance of this thinker, who offered, beyond his thinking on the bomb, pertinent and fruitful perspectives on technology and anthropology in our modern world. And I think he should be reinstated and added to the list of thinkers to whom we turn when we want to historicize and also systematize, I mean, offer a more systematic approach to thinking about the Cold War. So basically, what we get with Anders, who always thought that 6th of May 1945, the bombing of Hiroshima, was for him sort of a personal biographical caesura, but then also the dawn of a new age, we get a post-nuclear anthropology in which traditional categories of thinking about the human condition are reversed and have to be worked through again, with that notion of the discrepancy between producing and imagining at its core. Thank you.
So I'm going to talk about the British context of this, and it very much relates to what Benjamin was saying about the Anders's Promethean gap, this idea of that the technology exists, but the imaginative ability to properly conceptualize its consequences lags behind, and that people struggle to imagine the bomb properly. So when we started working on the book, it was about really for us constructing the mental world of the Cold War and understanding how they imagined the Cold War and thought about the Cold War, and how these imaginings underpinned politics and society in the Cold War, and how further to that the metaphors and the language used to imagine then ended up underpinning different things. So in particular, really, it was an attempt to move away from a cultural history of the Cold War, which emphasised only sort of individual collective examples of cultural production, the sort of almost cavalcade of one film or one book after another and what this said, to something a bit more, sort of what underpinned those attempts to imagine the Cold War. So what I'm going to talk about now is trying to talk about some of the factors that structured the ability of people to imagine nuclear war in the United Kingdom, and to think about, what structured that ability, and then to think about some of the consequences of that for British culture and society. Some of these factors, I think, are common to Cold War society more generally. Others, however, I think were quite specific to Britain, and one of the things we tried to do was try to talk about some of the sort of wider metaphorical underpinnings, but also to seek out sort of national specificity. So the first obvious factor which structured British culture's attempts to understand nuclear war was, of course, the scientific evidence and the images of nuclear destruction from Japan and, of course, nuclear testing. But what's crucial for us to realise that is that in the hydrogen bomb era, and the the rhetoric of testing and the rhetoric of destruction meant that scientific thought on nuclear weapons and their consequences was very, very patchy. You know, people didn't always understand the exact scientific nature of nuclear destruction. The scale of, you know, and for reasons I'll get onto, in Britain in particular, the scale of destruction was often stressed, but relatively rarely the limits. And the second factor then is this struggle, perhaps even inability, to conceptualise the destructive power and the limits of nuclear weapons in Britain. The hydrogen bomb in particular could destroy an entire city and kill millions of people, but each nuclear weapon, by its physical nature, had a limit on its destructiveness. I argue there was a basic imaginative gap, a difficulty in imagining nuclear war, which led to many people in Britain in the 50s and 60s to assume that such weapons would not only destroy a city, but would destroy the entire United Kingdom, and a few weapons would destroy the entire world. So, for example, you know, so what we see in British culture is very few attempts to try and imagine what the world would be like in and after a nuclear war. Instead, what we have is a great deal of attempts to dramatise the threat of nuclear war and the need to avert it, but which then stop when the bombs. The classic example of this would be the film Dr. Strangelove, which builds up to the climactic. Satirical event with the bombs going, and that's the end. And it's very striking in British culture how few examples there are of trying to attempt to understand what nuclear war might look like up until the mid-60s, compared with the huge number of attempts to imagine what nuclear war, what it might be like to survive a nuclear war, which happened from the mid-60s onwards. And it's a really big shift. So famous cultural things like, say, The War Game or Threads or and novel, you know, and a variety of novels. You know, there is a distinct chronological transition here, which is worth probing. But to go back, the other factor which really structures how nuclear war was understood in Britain, particularly in the 40s and 50s, is the British experience of the Second World War. Britain's successful defence against German air bombing and the centrality of that story to Britain's post-war identity helped create the impression for some that atomic war in particular, you know, before, you know, could be defended against and could be defended against quite easily. Moreover, I argue that the physical landscape of Britain's post-war cities with the remnants of the bombing campaigns all around them meant that for many people they framed imaginatively atomic war through their experiences either lived or imagined of bombing in the Second World War. Seeing the world around them, they imagined, they mapped a potential atomic war onto, you know, onto their memories of the Second World War. The result being that actually in the late 40s and early 50s, some people had an extremely optimistic view of how a nuclear war might be fought. An optimism that I think contrasted with how atomic culture was experienced in the United States in the same period. The fourth factor, though, really did change this, and that's the sense that after the hydrogen bomb test in the 54, the previous optimism was completely destroyed in the face of this new weapon. I think the urban nature of British society also contributed to this, because the sheer urban nature of British society meant that people struggled to imagine the continuation of British society and culture in the event of cities being destroyed. And so after 54, ironically, British culture began to be entirely pessimistic about the chances of survival, again in contrast to the belief common in the United States that evacuation and fallout shelters would preserve some sort of American society, whatever that might look like. That doesn't happen. There are remarkably few shelters ever built in the UK. And the final factor of this, I think, is Britain's own nuclear deterrent, which I think is really important for Britain's understanding, you know, of nuclear war. Because the British bomb was obviously a huge symbol of the nation's apparent ongoing world power, there was the ability of this weapon to deter was so continually emphasised in ways that tended to emphasise and exaggerate the destructive power of Britain's new toy, I mean bomb. The press narratives were all about how the fact that Britain in possessing such power could destroy the entire world, you know, was now on a par with the United States and the UK, it was unambiguously a good thing that a British Prime Minister could destroy anywhere it wanted. which is obviously what we have today with the ongoing debates about Trident. And ironically, although in my previous work on civil defence, I argued that the state and government tried to downplay the scale of nuclear destruction in terms of its impacts on Britain, the cultural purchase that civil defence had in Britain was significantly smaller than the cultural purchase that narratives about the deterrent had throughout. So I think these various factors had a variety of different consequences. The most obvious one, as I mentioned, was that there came a narrative in the 50s and 60s of total world-ending annihilation that must follow any nuclear exchange, which typified British cultural responses to the bomb and marginalised alternative ways of thinking about nuclear war. And I think there can be an argument that actually helped structure British attitudes to the ideological Cold War confrontation, and certainly I think structured attitudes to things like Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, which I think most people in, you know, lots large parts of British society didn't give much thought to, for example. Secondly, these narratives underpinned public support for the deterrent, as well as symbolically powerful, seemed to many as to have a basically sound intellectual rationale. If such weapons will destroy a nation so completely, the argument runs, no nation would use them. The next consequence, though, is that I believe the same narrative that, you know, these bombs would destroy the entire world underpin the moral power of the early peace movement as much as they did underpin arguments in favour of the deterrent. Here, of course, the intellectual moral arguments were reversed. If such weapons can destroy the entire world, how on earth can we allow them to exist, which is the basic argument of the Silent Campaign. Moreover, to convey this argument, nuclear protesters equally, and perhaps even more so, unknowingly exaggerated the power of these weapons to illustrate their world-ending power. And I do wonder whether seeing the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, if their arguments that the bomb must be banned because it would destroy the entire world did in some way unwittingly underpin public support for the nuclear deterrent. But that's an argument I do make. The final consequence, I think, the fourth consequence, there is another one, were the attempts, and there were extensive attempts, to try and break free of this model of imagining nuclear war as a binary division between the state of peace or pre-attack and the oblivion that would come. And in the 60s, people began to imagine what it might be like to survive a nuclear war and the horrors that post-attack life would involve. And that's very much an argument of the survivors would envy the dead, and surviving the war would be worse than dying in a war. And this is a decisive shift in the understanding of the imaginary war. And I think it was led partly by pro-disarmament artists, filmmakers and writers who wanted to renew the language of protest in the aftermath of the first wave of CND's failure to achieve its aims early in the decade. So I think they were trying to move on from this idea, from this binary idea of shocking people out of the fear of war, into attempts to try and persuade them into supporting disarmament through thinking about the shock of survival. And we can really, just to illustrate this, we can see this perhaps very briefly, from three works from the writer Doris Lessing in the famous classic work, The Golden Notebook, in 1962. She doesn't discuss nuclear war explicitly, but instead, and remember, this is a novel famous for its extensive discussion of interiority, in the mindset of its protagonist. The threat of nuclear war isn't conveyed through language, but through the pasting of a range of headlines about nuclear testing and its destructive power. You get the distancing, the inability to think about it in the novel. In the same year that the novel was published, she writes a television play called The Truth of Billy Newton, which has actually never been published, in which she tries to excavate, one of the first people trying to excavate, the emotional damage, the psychological damage rather than the emotional damage, that living under the shadow of the bomb is having on the family. It's only partially successful. But 7 years later after that, she writes the fourth novel of a series of novel called The Children of Violence, and it's called The Four Gated City. And that end, and then the novel sequence is really interesting, because it starts in the First World War, goes through the 20th century history, and ends in an imagined nuclear war in 1979, I believe it is. So within the space of a decade, we've got a complete shift and how one very thoughtful writer is imagining nuclear war in British culture. The final consequence, though, relates to memory. How nuclear war was imagined in Britain resulted in part from the political contest over nuclear war. And as I've said, both sides would illustrate their arguments by emphasising the scale of destruction. The memory of the Cold War emphasises this contest and neglects those voices who argued that civil defence would work or those who argued that a limited nuclear war was a viable proposition. And I think the two different sides here that of voices that have been very excluded from this historiography. E.P. Thompson's famous and much abused phrase about rescuing people from the condescension of posterity. I'm not sure I want my career to be rescuing people who have argued in favour of a limited nuclear war to be, you know, but there is a point where these are interesting voices which are often excluded. But in the, you know, and what I, you know, the research I've been trying to write up since we completed this volume, I've been trying to analyse the recorded memories of individuals who volunteered and served in Britain's civil defence organisation. And I know I'm not the only person doing that, because there's someone in the audience here who's working on similar areas. Whereas protesters, that people in CND or, you know, people at Greenham, can articulate their motivations and remember their stories and remember, you know, what, you know, why they were involved with a great deal of ease and their emotional responses. The civil defence volunteers I interviewed really struggle to sort of articulate and compose the narratives that are derived from the fact, you know, from what they did. And what's important here is that all historians argue that the ability of people to remember and narrate their story, their lives in composed sections, is greatly influenced by how contemporary culture sees those stories. And so for protesters, it's a very readily understandable language and people can explain it. But for people who basically spent their weekends and evenings trying to defend against all-out nuclear war, they struggle to articulate why that would work. So to conclude, to understand the threat of nuclear war, you know, and how it shaped Britain's culture and politics, requires us to understand how the ability to imagine nuclear war was structured and to understand the consequences of that imaginative struggle. And to realise that these ideas weren't static, they changed greatly in the course of the Cold War, and this is part of our project very much to move away from an overly monolithic Cold War. But also it does continue to shape how we and others historicise the period today.
Hello, and thank you to our kind hosts. I'm honored to be here at LSE. I come from the state of Ohio, which used to be a swing state in the United States. In the last two, the 2008 and 2012 elections, many people in Ohio were proud to put President Obama over the top. But this time around, we're not quite so sure what will happen, and we apparently are no longer a swing state. Are there any other Americans in the room? Wow, then I must, no? No?
Shy American.
What state?
California,
okay. Well, I just wanted to, since there are very few of us represented in the room, I wanted to redeem my nation and say, first of all, that I was surprised to find, discover something that I agreed with Donald Trump about. And I know that I shouldn't come as a foreigner to come to talk about my own politics, but I was able to find at least one thing in the recent presidential debate. The Donald said that he thought that nuclear weapons are important. And with that, I agree. I did not agree with his next point, which was he disagreed with his opponent, Hillary Clinton, who said that climate change was even more important than nuclear weapons. He said, no, climate change is something that's just a hoax invented by the Chinese. So we part ways there. So I wrote a chapter for this book about Japan, and most of the rest of the contributions focus on Europe and the United States. And I was very grateful to the editors for including other parts of the world who were profoundly implicated in, influenced by, and shaped the Cold War, including East Asia. And there are many studies that have come out in recent years about the Cold War in East Asia. In my short time today, I'd like to just make two points that I tried to work with in my chapter. And I think this volume that Matthew and Benjamin have edited succeed in demonstrating very well the various contributions in sound ways to study the imagination of the Cold War. My first point that I will look at is to think about how profoundly locality matters. The local, one must pay attention to the local, even though we call the Cold War a global phenomenon, a global historical and social process and cultural process. And this, the importance of the local is very much there because the imaginary and the weight of the different signifiers were not always common in the Cold War. I was thinking about Donald Trump again in the United States in a recent week or so since the famous tapes on Friday, those Friday lewd tapes. There have been a lot of more and more associations with Donald Trump and masculinity and bombs. And in the United States, and this has been written about a lot by Paul Boyer and many other illustrious historians, that American culture tends to trivialize nuclear weapons and to, there's a lot of nuclear kitsch, right, I'm sure you've seen. And so on the cover of a recent New York Times magazine, there's something that looks like a nuclear weapon, but there's also a microphone, and it says right-wing air war, Donald Trump and the battle within conservative media. So he and one of his primary weapons, the microphone, is associated with a nuclear weapon. And on this week's Economist, there was a meltdown. I think it was the United States politics are starting to melt down, and Trump is a central agent. So part of my own local history involves that type of long cultural expression of nukes. So the local is important. And my other point today is, again, realized well in this volume, is that constantly historicizing social movements, social thoughts, and historical context is essential when studying the Cold War. And this seems commonsensical, but we often use the term as something, some monolithic term. So my first point, that we must pay attention to the local when studying the Cold War. And here I have a slide of the Peace Park in Hiroshima. Has anyone been to Hiroshima? And you can still visit the Peace Park today. It's a very beautiful place, and I recommend it highly. This is a photograph of the Peace Park in Hiroshima in 1962. Even now, 71 years after the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945, people in Japan often talk about Japan's national identity in terms of the bombing and call Japan the only nation ever to be bombed by atomic weapons in wartime, Yuitsu no Hibaku Koku. And over the past 5 years since 3/11, since the Fukushima tsunami earthquake and nuclear meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear plant, that aspect of Japanese national identity has been brought up repeatedly in the media and in many writings and studies. So when studying the Cold War in Japan, at least as a local phenomenon, it behooves us to pay attention to the survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings of August 6th and August 9th, 1945, who I'm using here as a shorthand, as they, in a sense, embody this status of Japan as a nation. The term we use in Japanese for atomic bomb survivor is hibakusha. It means a person who has been exposed to the bombing. And here in the slide, we see sitting here in the center an older gentleman, Mr. Moritaki Ichiro, who survived the Hiroshima atomic bombing in 1945. A philosopher and a professor by occupation, Mr. Moritaki, by this time, 1962, so about 17 years after the bombing, had become the leader of a major hibakusha or survivor organization that advocated for the medical and social needs of A-bomb survivors, which were plenty. He was also a well-known and outspoken anti-nuclear activist. And I would note here that not all A-bomb survivors were anti-nuclear activists. Here we see Mr. Moritake protesting nuclear weapons testing, as we have heard through the 50s and into the 60s, into the early 60s, there were more and more powerful, especially atmospheric, tests of nuclear devices by the United States and others. So there's an extensive literature available in English language. Many of a lot of this literature draws on Japanese sources, these English sources that can help us understand the lived experience and the historical context of the hibakusha, the survivors, as well as understanding their visible scars. Some of their visible scars were keloids that were caused by the atomic weapons, which are somewhat different than regular burns from incendiary bombs or napalm. But also the hidden scars of the hibakusha, which were often psychological and emotional, but also, and most significantly, I think, consequences of high or low dosage radiation exposure from the atomic bombings. Now, this photograph you see shows Mr. Moritake and other hibakusha, other survivors. You see some women here who are engaging very publicly in anti-nuclear protests. The women over here on your right are collecting signatures for anti-bomb test, hydrogen bomb test testing. And so they're here in the public park. But in fact, many of the hibakusha chose not to expose themselves to public scrutiny. They were afraid often of social discrimination. Are your genes strange because you've been exposed to these strange kind of weapons? We may not give you a job. Would you be a suitable person to marry my son or my daughter for these reasons? Many hibakusha were also reluctant to reveal their poverty or the joblessness that plagued many of them. So, and especially in the early decades after the end of the war in 1945, so from the 50s and even into the 60s, many or some people in other parts of Japan regarded hibakusha, the survivors, in negative terms for various reasons. Sometimes they were thought of as symbols of Japan's defeat in the Asia-Pacific War, World War II, because of the proximity of the bombings and the end of the war. And whether that's the bombings brought the war to an end is a huge debate that I won't go into right now. And some people outside of Hiroshima especially resented hibakusha because of the public focus that was placed on them. So often people resented them because of this focus was placed on them rather than the trauma experienced by sufferers of conventional warfare, the kind of air war that happened in this city, in London, and many other cities throughout Europe and in other parts of Asia, and most major and medium-sized cities in Japan and in China as well. So during the 50s and 1960s, some hibakusha chose to speak out against the alarming nuclear arms race, especially between the United States and the Soviet Union, and then other countries joined in. And this advanced technology, as it became increasingly powerful and radioactively toxic with these thermonuclear weapons. For Mr. Moritake and others, the act of witnessing, of telling of their own experiences during the bombing and its long aftermath was explicitly political and ethical in nature. Engagement with an international, transnational social movement against the bomb, and even though they're in the Peace Park in Hiroshima here doing something very local, they did gain legitimacy from and looked to activists, anti-nuclear activists in Britain and other parts of the world. And for many hibakusha, this engagement with activism gave them a sense of purpose despite the social discrimination and medical and psychological challenges and poverty that many of them faced. Yet at the same time, and this is something that's very locally specific to Japan, this kind of witnessing, which we can see is something very noble and courageous on the part of the Hibakusha, was also very controversial because precisely because of the fraught Cold War context. To name one context that made it very controversial is the U.S.-Japan Security Alliance, which continues today and into the future, unless Mr. Trump becomes president, and then all bets are off, we don't know. And this U.S.-Japan Security Alliance was a keystone of U.S. containment policy in East Asia, as it still is, or as of U.S. security policy and military policy in East Asia. And it meant that the Hibakusha themselves, even as they protested nuclear weapons, along with other Japanese citizens, were perched under America's nuclear umbrella, and also were citizens of a country that hosted extensive hundreds, literally hundreds, of U.S. military bases. And the relevance of that I'll explain in a minute. So in this context, the city of Hiroshima was then and is still today a very odd kind of pilgrimage site. And people go there. Mother Teresa went there. The Pope goes there. Many world leaders, President Obama, went there recently. It's a kind of a strange, sacred city of peace. And perhaps during the discussion, we can talk more about this strange Cold War notion of peace, which was also discussed brilliantly in the introduction to the volume. Here we see Mr. Moritake again speaking at one of the international congresses that was held annually in Hiroshima against atomic and hydrogen weapons. And delegates came from countries all over the world, from the East Bloc and the West Bloc. And there were debates about and very much polarization. It was very actually polemic and not peaceful at all. And many Eastern Bloc delegates and some Japanese socialists and communists harshly lambasted U.S. possession and testing of nukes, while others condoned Soviet possession of H-bombs as being, well, okay, because the Soviets' intentions were peaceful. Mr. Moritake, in this image, was advocating for disarmament and an end to nuclear proliferation by all nations. The term in Japanese is ikanaru kuni. All nations should give up their arms. And this, he was very passionate and sincere in this and understood that his ethical authority was based on his experience. He had been in Hiroshima. He had experienced something of these weapons, even though the atomic weapons that were used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were only a thousandth in terms of magnitude of the hydrogen bombs, thermonuclear bombs that were being tested at this time. I was often surprised to read by a contemporary reportage by the very famous Nobel Prize-winning author Oe Kenzaburo that Mr. Moritake was standing up in front of this anti-nuclear gathering, booed by the crowd. He offered words of in memory of the dead, and he also spoke up in his message, anti-nuclear message, but some of the crowd were impatient with him and said, "What, you're calling yourself a victim? Japan was an imperialist power. Japan was a militarist, expansionist power. How can you claim victimhood?" So, again, my first point is paying attention to the local and connecting that to the global. Point number two I'd like to talk briefly about has to do with historicizing these different phases of imagination of nuclear weapons and nuclear culture and the nuclear regime during the Cold War. And that includes cultural representation, social activism, and the bomb in civil society. Here, so the Hibakusha, I've spoken briefly about the Hibakusha, the survivors, and their own social engagement in civil society. But my chapter in this book is about a specific incident that happened in the 1960s, which is a very different stage than the anti-nuclear weapon conference that I just spoke about. We have a very odd, I think a really unusual instance of transnational activism that was prominent in the 1960s, much of which surrounded student movement or anti-Vietnam War activism. But I argue in my chapter that these kind of unexpected encounters led in very interesting ways to knowledge construction, solidarity, and were sought out by groups that were seeking transnational solutions for global issues. And how successful those interactions were is yet another question. So in the mid-1960s, Mr. Moritake and other Hibakusha representatives and advocates in Hiroshima met with leaders of a very different kind of social activist group, and that was an anti-Vietnam War group called Beheiren, which is, in English, Citizens Alliance for Peace in Vietnam. And this Beheiren was a Japanese group of young writers, university students like yourselves, intellectuals, who organized a series of teach-ins all over the country, debates and lectures about the U.S. war, United States war in Vietnam. And one of their sites was in Hiroshima. The leaders of Beheiren, this anti-Vietnam War group, were Oda Makoto and Tsurumi Shinsuke, who were very, very prominent intellectuals and writers. And they were protesting not nuclear weapons. They were of a much younger generation than Hibakusha, but they were protesting a hot war, the proxy war that was the war, America's war in Vietnam. And remarkably, I find it really remarkable that Oda and Tsurumi, the leaders of this group, and you see them marching in the street, and you can see that there's English sign, peace in Vietnam, Betonam ni Heiwa, all peace for Vietnam in Japanese. They invited guests from the United States. They invited anti-Vietnam War activists. But among those many anti-Vietnam War activists, they brought from the very country that was waging that war in Vietnam, that proxy war that was central to the Cold War, were two young historians and civil rights leaders. One of them was Howard Zinn, and if you have studied American history, you're probably familiar with Howard Zinn. He was a professor at Boston College and wrote some very radical and popular textbooks and alternate visions of American history. And he also wrote about SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was one of the most highly respected civil rights groups in the United States. So he was invited to Japan by Beheiren, and you can see him here in front of the 1964 Tokyo Olympics stadium. Another civil rights activist, anti-Vietnam War activist, who was invited was Ralph Featherstone, who was indeed a civil rights leader from Student Nonviolence Coordinating Committee. Now, one question I pose in my chapter is, what would these people talk about? What would Hibakusha and anti-Vietnam War groups and civil rights groups talking about? And by the way, by civil rights here at this time in the United States, we often think of civil rights as being mainly having to do with voting rights. And indeed, the civil rights movements, especially in this era for various reasons, became very narrowed focus on voting rights. But the civil rights movement in the United States, and especially people like Ralph Featherstone and Howard Zinn and others, also focused on social and economic rights and so on. So these are very diverse activist groups. And so I try to think in my chapter about what they would have to talk about together. And one of the things I focus on is the context of an articulation of the concept of universal human rights. And we think, oh, human rights, now and then, the same always. But post-1945, the aftermath of the world wars, the wars of the 30s and the 40s, there's definitely a shift in the concept and the articulation of the universality that all human beings, not just certain human beings, should be recognized as having these rights, and that there should be international standards to enforce this. And um, along with the Hibakusha in Hiroshima, there were many local journalists and the media as well who engaged with this concept of civil rights. And in my chapter, I look at the way that this becomes a common value and something for these groups to come together along. So my second point is, again, a finely grained historical view of different phases of local and global Cold War currents is very important. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. Excellent. Well, I think we've had...